Please welcome Jane L. from Tallahassee, Florida.
We as alcoholics need hope. We thrive on it. We share it. And those of us in H&I love to hear how people who are confined get the message of hope and recovery, because we love to do what we do in H&I. And I am very excited now to introduce our speaker, Jane L. from Tallahassee, Florida.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jane, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so happy to be here. I heard this is a big deal. And I heard so enthusiastically by Linda, who just introduced me, who, by the way, is just as lovely in appearance as you are on the phone. Your voice is just so beautiful and your face just matches it. And thank you so much for being such a lovely host. We've touched base several times throughout the last 6 months, and I've been looking so forward to this. And I also wanna thank my friend Doug R. And let me tell you something. If there was a Hollywood Squares of AA, Doug would be the Paul Lynde, okay? and because I hear, Doug, you were kind enough to suggest that I share today to Linda. So thank you. And I have one more very special shout out to my beautiful mother-in-law, who I see in the audience, Polly P., and the birthday boy, Dave P., my stepfather-in-law. And I don't think there are two people that have given as much of their lives to AA as those two. And Dave, happy birthday. I love you so much. Anyway, so my name is Jane and I'm an alcoholic. And I wanted to just let you know a little bit about myself before I share with this amazing group of people that has such a special place in my heart. And it's going to be an interesting twist, because I haven't had the opportunity to do much service in the realm of H&I, but I can tell you that I was the recipient of your services. And I appreciate your dedication, your open-mindedness, your courage, and just your kind hearts that are willing to help this population. And I'm here to tell you, you made such a difference in my life. And I'm getting choked up when I say that, but it's so true. So thank you everyone for the service that you do. It's so important and it does make a difference. But a little bit about myself, I figure what I'll do is I'll share a little bit of my story, and then I'll go into my experiences in prison. And then of course, some of my post-prison miracles. But first off, I'd like to say I thank this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thank my amazing God, who I best can describe as love. I thank my sponsor and my sponsors throughout the years, and my sponsees who help me way more than I help them. And I know you know what I'm talking about. And my family, who I put through hell for so many years, and was able, thankfully, to rebuild my relationship with them through this program. But thanks to all the aforementioned, I have been clean and sober since September 24th of 1996. Woo! And that is truly a miracle. And my home group is Central Group here in Tallahassee, Florida. And it's been my home group since the day I got out of prison. And I'll tell you about that moving forward. But I am so grateful for this non-religious spiritual path that we're all on together. And I want to thank everyone here too for teaching me how to live life honestly and truthfully and lovingly. And, I know that this is called Unconventional Convention. And how lucky we are. You know, I woke up this morning just, so grateful, so filled with gratitude First of all, because I'm free. and secondly, because, you know, we have this ability to still maintain our social connections that are so important to our recovery. You know, so thank goodness we have this forum in this day and age that we can share. And also, I can't help but to think how lucky we are that we have this set of spiritual principles and this set of spiritual practices that we can implement into our lives during difficult times such as this, during challenging times such as this. You know, because I don't know about you, but I have been, since last March, I have been turning it over constantly, you know. And not only do I know that everything's going to be okay, everything is okay. I know that a power greater than all of us is in charge of this. And there are so many lessons. Many of them have already been revealed. But I think on the other side of this, we'll be able to look back and see, truly see the all of the lessons that we've learned. And one of my favorite mantras is, if you want peace, be peace. And I have been doing that a lot since the inception of this pandemic. But also I want to say too, that this hasn't been that difficult for me because I was in prison, you know? And, you know, for me, this has been, while it's had its challenges, I've actually sort of enjoyed it for many of the reasons that I enjoyed prison. You know, when I was in prison, I lived out of a footlocker, you know, for 5 years. And there's a sort of beauty in simplifying our external lives, because I really feel like when we do that and we get rid of the clutter and we don't have the distraction and we're not caught up in the rat race and we're, you know, not busy, 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 we really can have a clutter-free heart. And I feel like I was able to really listen to God and really find out who I truly was as a result of simplifying my life. And I just wanted to share that. And of course, I know that, you know, if I continue to live in the present moment, then all my fears are kept at bay. And, you know, I feel just so lucky and so free, even though we're in these confined, you know, situations right now. But anyway, I don't know about you, but for me, until the pain got strong enough, I wasn't going to change. And we all know from our literature, sometimes our dark past can end up being our greatest gift. And I know that one of the main spiritual principles that I've learned to live by is that when I give, I get back. So once again, I'm just so grateful that I've been asked to share my experiences this morning and with all of you. So a little bit about myself. Yes, I'm from Tallahassee, Florida, but originally I'm from the great state of New Jersey. And I have, you know, just happy memories of my childhood. I come from a big Irish Catholic family, and I have always believed in God. And, you know, a little bit about my family. My parents had 7 kids. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad I always love to share a little bit about my dad because I'm so proud of him. He was actually favored to be the first ever to break the 4-minute mile. And he just missed it. He ran a 4.00.02. So it says a lot about his dedication, his focus, his work ethic. And he instilled that into every single one of us kids, you know. And as a matter of fact, he is probably getting his vaccine right now. He had a 1 o'clock New Jersey appointment. So thank goodness. He's 89. My mom's 85. And they're celebrating in May 63 years of marriage. So I'm sharing all of this because I'm sure you can imagine I had a happy childhood. My parents loved us, nurtured us. My dad was tough, as I said, but But yeah, there's no reason why I should have walked the road that I did. But we have this little thing in our psyche, if you're an alcoholic, that's loves defiance and loves risk taking and loves rebellion. And that's my story. So my childhood, I went to Catholic schools. I'm one of those Catholics that had really wonderful experiences with the nuns and priests in my life. I went to an all-girl Catholic high school. And I'll tell you something, those nuns were the first feminists I ever met. They implored us to always be fiercely independent, to get our educations, and never to rely on anyone to take care of us. And so I had renegade nuns. They were really cool. As a matter of fact, I'm still in touch with a lot of them today. And I'll just jump to my first drink. Why don't we go ahead and cut to the core? So everyone loves a first drink story. I love mine. I was 14 years old and my cousin took me and a bunch of her friends to the movies. She was 18, bought two bottles of rum. We went into the movies with rum in tow. And we got those big Cokes and she just kept dumping rum into my Coke. And I just remember sitting in those movie theater seats like, wow, this is so cool. Looking up at that big screen. And the movie was the original Star Wars. You know, it's so funny you can't make this stuff up, right? And actually, I was just able to rewatch Star Wars not too long ago when we got the Disney Channel. And I marveled at, how kind of hokey it was. Back then it was cutting edge stuff. And I just remember sitting in my seat like, whoa, this is so cool. I was flying around intergalactically. It took me out of this world and put me in this whole other plane. And man, I loved it. And I'll tell you, they say that our first drink leaves the most important imprint in our brains. And that's the one that it left in mine. It was outrageous, fun. I wanted people to be like, oh yeah, the party's about to begin. Jane's here, and plain Jane was gone forever. And I wanted to be extraordinary Jane. And to tell you succinctly, that's what I went for every single time I drank. Now, I got sick as a dog and I wasn't like, oh, I can't wait to do that again because of how sick I got. And there were a couple of times in high school where, I drank and, smoked a little weed, but not really. I was very few and far between. I was the all-American kid in high school. Went away to college and I went to Manhattan College in New York City. And this was in the 1980s. And New York City was everything all the time. And I know we're not supposed to have an opinion on outside issues, but I have one. I absolutely loved them. I loved cocaine and I loved smoking weed. But singleness of purpose means so much to me. I have to emphasize that those things only helped to amplify my drinking. Drinking was the love of my life. And this is when I started, drinking and partying and, it's so funny because, I had like this fear of living a half-lived life. The kids today call it FOMO, fear of missing out. And, I just was loving the freedom. As I said, it was New York City in the 80s. So it was all the big clubs, like the Limelight, Studio 54, the Tunnel, the Peppermint Lounge. I mean, one of my claims to fame is I saw the Talking Heads and the Ramones at CBGB's. I mean, and I was out there doing it, folks. And, because I was like so caught up in the social life, it's almost like that's what I think I was addicted to early on. And, I was running on self-sufficiency and ego this big. I got this. Self-reliance, self-will, pride, and oh my gosh. And if I had to put into a nutshell how I identified myself, here it goes. I was a hell-raising, rule-breaking, risk-taking, rock and roll chick, man. And I wanted to live that rock and roll lifestyle. And I did everything I could to do that. And I'll tell you something. I actually, you name the band, I saw them at Madison Square Garden, right? And I actually had the opportunity to party with quite a few of them, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's just when you were out there, you just, you know, I mean, New York was crazy back in those days. So you get the deal. That was what I went for. And I'll tell you, when I graduated from, I had a bunch of geographic changes. I'm not going to get into all of them. But my first one, and I didn't even know it was called, there was a name for it, was when I was a junior in college, I went overseas and I studied in France for a year. And a semester. And I remember thinking, I'm about to be a senior. I better get my act together. I'm out of New York, clean up, clean slate. Nobody knows me over there. And this was my first massive fail at a geographic change. I went over to France. I lived with a French family and they had a 19-year-old nanny living with them. And I tore up that little city of Nantes, just like I was tearing up New York City back in the States. So that kind of became a pattern. And again, I'm not going to share all the geographic changes, but there were quite a few of them. I moved back. I graduated. I taught high school for many years. Well, several years. And I moved to a city called Hoboken, New Jersey. And I think Hoboken has the world record for the most amount of bars in one square mile. So I taught high school by day and I worked in an Irish pub at night. My life was chaos. This is when my family stopped inviting me to family functions. This is, I think, notable because all of the lines that I said I would never cross, I started to cross. I always chose drinking men, you know, and I would become incapable of acting like a woman with any kind of integrity or dignity. And I would have sad, semi-consensual experiences, wake up in a haze filled with shame and regret and guilt. And the only thing that would ease that discomfort was taking up another drink and starting that whole thing over again. And this became my cycle. My morals started to slip. I held on to them for a while, good Catholic girl that I was. But when this cycle started, it was like, oh, well, you know, I opened a can of worms. And yeah, I started dating a married guy that I was teaching with, you know, things that I would never have done. Again, I had another substantial geographic change after I lost those jobs teaching at those high schools. I had the opportunity to go teach in Japan for a year. And I ended up staying for three because let me tell you, life in Japan is really easy to live as a functioning alcoholic. Just to put it in a nutshell, I hooked up with a bunch of crazy Australians, Brits, New Zealanders, Canadians. And, you know, I mean, we would have been arrested weekly if we were doing that stuff in our respective countries that we could get away with doing in Japan. I'll tell you, I ended up staying for 3 years, as I said, because it was so easy. I had a great job too. I taught English to Japanese businessmen who were about to be shipped overseas, and I had to stay in the training center with them for a month. So I had to eat breakfast, lunch, dinner with them, and every night we would just drink. So this is, I mentioned this part of my life because this is yet another indication of my slipping into alcoholism, okay? This is when I started to need a drink when I woke up in the morning just to feel right. I couldn't wait till lunch to have a couple of nips to go bring out the afternoon and then boom, it was on at five, you know? After 3 years, I thought, oh, my family probably misses me a lot. I better get home. I want to, you know, straighten out my act and maybe get married and have a family and kids and the way that I was conditioned to think happiness means. And I moved home and it was just a lot of disappointment. Instead of my family being like, yeah, she's home, they were like, oh God, she's back and she's worse than ever. You know, my poor parents and my siblings, you know, and my siblings all partied like I did when they were younger, you know, in college, but they were just saying, Jane, you're out of control. You know, first of all, you're never going to meet a nice guy. Secondly, you know, the pain that you're putting mom and dad through and us, it's like, we don't even know you anymore. And I was like, don't worry, I got this, leave me alone. And then they started to make me feel like a black sheep. And so in retort, I would like do something at them, you know, like that really was self-harm, you know, it was self-harm. It's like, oh yeah, you think I'm that bad? Watch this. Anyway, you get the drift. And things went on like that for a long time. Almost as soon as I moved home, I got my first DUI. And I remember I lost my license for 6 months, and a friend of mine had a restaurant down in Florida. So this is how I ended up in Florida. He said, come on down here. You can ride your bike everywhere. I'll give you a job in my restaurant, you know, this and that. And so I moved down, and I kid you not, I figured, okay, nobody knows me down in Florida. I'll straighten out my act again. I'll try and, you know, really quit drinking and start being, you know, acting like a lady again. Well, guess where his restaurant was? The Florida Keys. We know that that little experiment was a massive fail. And as a matter of fact, the Keys is where I really hit that incomprehensible demoralization that that we all know so well. I always like to call my time in the Keys my fade to black. The Keys is where I really hit the skids. I wasn't able to keep that waitressing job for very long. And before I knew it, I was homeless. I was couch surfing at best. My family, I just couldn't deal with them anymore because I didn't want to feel the shame that they always made me feel. And I was on really like a suicide run. It was like the road to self-destruction, but I didn't have the courage to kill myself. So I would just continuously do things that were self-harmful. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just blow my heart up or drink myself to death. And that'll show them, you know, that kind of thing. And I wanted to let you know, to just say this about God. You know, I always knew that God really understood the language of my heart. There were times when even when I was in this darkness that I would still go to Mass, you know. And I remember thinking, you know, God understands me. God gets this. Even when I was, let me just back up for a minute. I remember even when I was, you know, living that terrible lifestyle near home, I would still go home to see my family once a month and do the readings at Mass. And, you know, because I figured God knows me and loves me. He knows my heart is good. He's not judging me right now. God just is letting me do my thing and sow my wild oats and get this out of my system. I know you got me, God, you know, and those are the kind of conversations that I would have with them. As a matter of fact, just a quick, funny story. I remember one time after, of course, being with my married boyfriend up all night, drinking and drugging and going, oh God, I have to read the meetings at Mass tomorrow, getting in my car, driving to Mass. And my parents just, you know, I remember seeing them in the, you know, in the audience with my siblings, and they were just like, oh God, I bet she's wasted. And I remember I got up and I said, this is a letter from St. Paul to the Filipinos. You know, I was so wasted. And I remember them just like, oh my God, you know? But I say that because even then, I feel like God always had my back, you know, and wouldn't abandon me. So in my darkest hours down in the Keys, I would still call out to God. And one of these times I feel like he heard me and I really tried to get it together. I met a guy and he actually was living in Europe at the time. And And this one weekend, I had moved up to Fort Lauderdale to get away from the Keys. And this one time he wanted to go back down to the Keys to check out the water sports. So this is what happened. And it's never easy for me to share this part of my story. So we went down, and I remember the first tiki bar we hit, we went in and started having drinks in Isla Mirada, and we did this progressing all the way down to Marathon Key. And I remember that night thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great to go watch the sunset? And they had this thing called the 7 Mile Bridge. Now, unbeknownst to me, they had just blown that bridge up for the movie True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And we went down, and I thought it would be like just a scenic overview point. So we went down that bridge road, and it was kind of cool. So we watched the sunset, and then we spent a night out drinking and, you know, partying and dancing and having fun. And I had another great idea. Let's go back down to that bridge and watch the sun come up. So off we go with all of our ammunition in the car. And I remember this time seeing a sign that said authorized vehicles only. I was like, oh, well, vehicles, let's go. And down this road we went. And I remember I had just turned to him and I said, oh, my gosh, this is so weird, Max. Where is this road leading to? And out of nowhere came this cement barrier that I barreled right into, probably going 40 miles an hour. And I just remember this crack of thunder, this noise, like I've never heard anything like it before. And I opened my eyes and I could see just fire and smoke. And then I tried to move and I felt this whole, like this bolt of lightning go through to my very core, pain. It was this fiery pain. And I was just like, oh my God. Oh my God, Max, wake up. How are we going to get out of here? This thing's going to blow. And I remember looking at Max and it looked like he hit his head and he was just passed out. And I remember I put my hand down to my ankle and I felt the bones in my ankle. My knees got smashed up against the dashboard and I completely shattered my pelvis. And I broke my neck at C1, C2. So my whole left side was paralyzed. And I was just like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And I was like, wake up, wake up. And I think you know what I'm about to say. Max was not going to wake up. As a matter of fact, it took a while for it to sink in. I don't know, some weird kind of denial. But it was when his hands were turning cold, I realized that he was dead and that he wasn't breathing. And, I can't even begin to tell you what I went through, what my thoughts were. Well, I can tell you my first thought. It was like, God, please take me too. There's no way I can live with myself knowing that this precious life was abbreviated because of this drunk driver, you know? I started saying all my prayers. My ribs punctured my lungs, so it was very difficult to breathe. And I knew that I was on my last breaths. And all of a sudden I saw the blue lights in my rearview mirror. And I remember I was just shocked that this police officer was being so kind and loving to me. He was rubbing my hair. He was telling me to keep breathing and that they were going to, that help was on the way. They were going to cut me out of the car and to hang in there. And I'll tell you something. I want to share this because later on at one of the court hearings, the police officer told me that he actually had a life-changing experience that night because he said he was just proceeding down the regular bridge road. And it was almost like this higher power tapped him on the shoulder and told him to back up and go down that other bridge road, the old bridge road that was blocked off. And he said the compulsion was so strong that he couldn't deny it. So he did. And when he went and he saw the crash at the end, it was like he wasn't even surprised to see it. That's how strong the pull was for him to go down there. So he said he actually wanted to share that with me because it was life-changing for him too. And for some reason, that made me feel a little better. Like, it made me feel like maybe there's a reason why God left me here or something. And, you know, and now I have to, the responsibility of trying to figure out what that reason was, you know. So anyway, fast forward to the hospital. I got heliported to the University of Miami Hospital, where I was to spend the next many months. And when I got out, and I want to talk about my first AA meetings, because it was when I was in the hospital. So I remember my dad, one of the first memories I recall when I was coming back to, I remember seeing my dad over my hospital bed, and the first thing that I said to him was, "Dad, this didn't happen because I was drinking." Can you believe that? And I'll never forget that look on his face, you know? And I remember one of the things that he said was, "You better get some help, because if you don't, you can kiss your family goodbye." And if you knew my father, you knew that he meant it. And I could sense the tension. My mom came a couple days later, and there was big tension between my mom and dad. And later on, I found out it was because my mother was of the opinion, "You know what? We've been waiting for this phone call for 14 years. She made her bed, let her lay in it." And my dad was like, "Are you kidding? This is our daughter. We need to be here to support her." And my mom just bailed on me. And my siblings were upset because my mom and dad, actually, it almost led to them getting divorced. And so my siblings then just backed out of everything. So when I was out of the woods, my parents left and pretty much said, "You're on your own." So I went to that first AA meeting. As soon as I could get out of bed, I slid, they made a sliding board for me into the wheelchair, and I went to the AA meeting. And I'll tell you, I was just like, "God bless these people for coming in here, but this ain't for me, you know? I don't have the problems that they have." This was just, yeah, I mean, crazy, right? That denial that we have is something that now, on the other side of it, we know only something of a spiritual nature can break through it. But I was just like, what a bunch of weirdos, you know? I mean, what is this, some kind of cult? Oh man, you know? But then after going for a little while, I started to meet some pretty cool people. And I was like, and I started opening my mind up to the fact, like, these are cool people, like I'm cool. And like, you know, I heard some rock stars were in recovery and some cool actors were in recovery. So I loved having that as an example, you know? I said, you know, maybe it's time for me to get sober. You know, these people are cool and they're sober. And if we didn't get sober, I almost died. They'd probably be dead too if they didn't get sober. That's how cool they are. So those were some of the thoughts that I was having when I was in the hospital. But I started going because I had to go. I had to do it to please my family. Then when I got out of the hospital, after 5 months, I was let out on my own recognizance, and the judge told me I could only go to AA meetings or to physical therapy. So I moved to St. Pete Beach, and I really plugged into an AA group there. I went to a 7 a.m. meeting every single morning, and those people really helped to save my life. And I'm grateful that I had the experiences that I had in the hospital, because they opened the window for me to even, you know, want to do that. And I knew I had to do it too, but you know, the rebellion and the defiance that we have, it was because my family was telling me I had to do it. But this was different. This was like, you know, I was doing it, but then I really started, having had the window open, I jumped in St. Pete. And those people were with me during my darkest hours. And I always love to talk a little bit about step one at this point. You know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. And while all of us are, the depths of our bottom are different to all of us, you know, this, I felt utter defeat. I felt humiliation. I hurt myself. I hurt people that I love. There was a life that was no longer with us as a result, you know? I mean, the pain was mitigated by knowing that I surrendered, you know? And I was ready, you know? And one of the things that I heard you all tell me was, you know what? You got to drop that mask. You have to stop rationalizing. Stop pointing the finger of blame at everybody else and admit that your life is unmanageable. And I, after taking a long, cold, hard look, I admitted it. And I feel like the other thing that you shared with me that I really took to heart was it's time for you to abandon that fierce Irish pride that you have and start seeking humility. And that was not easy for me to do. But that's when I started doing it. I also heard things like this: step one is the first step towards the solution. It's the one that, it's the only one that you have to do perfectly. You know, we've probably all heard that stuff before. And acceptance of step one is profound. And I really started buying into that. You know, I have to say some of the things that really struck me in step one was, there's great power in powerlessness, you know? I could wrap my head around that. It kind of took the edge off the weakness of surrendering kind of thing. And I also wanted to tell you that one of the other lines that I loved hearing about, even the 12-step program in general, is give up, clean up, make up, and grow up. I love that saying, you know? And so to me, When they told me that's what this program was all about, it really helped me be like, okay, it's time for me to do that. But the thing that I heard loudest was honesty. And honesty is what I took in those really dark hours, you know? It was time for me to get honest, you know? As a result of all of you sharing how it's all about honesty and I had to make a commitment to live an honest lifestyle, I went against what my attorney told me was to plead not guilty because that road should have been blocked off. I was like, I'm accepting 100% responsibility for this. I am pleading guilty. I want to do my time. I know I'm going to prison, but I also want to be able to sleep at night. You know, I'm sure all of us that have been in the rooms for a long time have seen so many people just try and get out of it, you know? And some of them do, many of them do. And I've actually had people share with me that it was their demise because they once again got away with it and didn't, you know, pay the piper kind of thing. And plus it set the scene, if I can get away with this, I can get away with other things. So, you know, so I was like, no, if I'm gonna live this AA lifestyle, I need to be honest. And there's no way I can get up on that stand and say not guilty. So anyway, that's what I did. I pled guilty and I got sentenced to 5 years in prison, followed by 10 years of probation. Now, you know, I want to talk about prison for a while right now. I want to talk about my prison experience, but I want to start out by saying I am so grateful that I got 5 years in prison. I needed to go on a mining expedition to find out who I was because I had no idea who I was without alcohol and drugs. You know, 14 years, most of my grown-up years, I was, you know, blotto. And I just feel, as I mentioned at the very beginning, that I needed to be segregated from society. I needed to be quarantined off somewhere so I could really look at my life and think about how I was going to change my life. And, in prison, I suffered so many consequences. I was able to experience that powerlessness on a daily basis. You know, and again, I was forced to look at my unmanageability. I was in a state prison, and I don't think it gets any worse than state prison. Any prison's bad, but, the prison that I was in was a privatized prison. I would not feed the food that I fed to my dog. You know, we all know what private prisons are all about. I think it's back in my day when this happened, when I became incarcerated in 1996, October 12th, 1996 is when I was incarcerated. And I, that was like when the private prisons were in full swing. And I remember the estimates that year. It was the Department of Corrections paid $32,000 per year per inmate if we were housed in a Department of Corrections facility. But I was housed in a private facility. And I'm telling you, if they spent $3,000 on me that year, that was a lot. it was terrible. The food was just, I mean, disgusting. I'm amazed I still have teeth and hair. And the medical care was abominable. I had a lot of medical issues, especially early on. My foot was actually severed and they had to sew it back on. So I'm permanently on my tiptoe, and it took like a year for them to get me the proper shoe to wear. And I was in a real quandary too, because they wouldn't let me use a cane. It took something like 6 months for me to get permission to use a cane. So I could barely walk. And that on top of just, you know, every day being debased and demeaned and degraded. And just like I mentioned at the beginning in the quarantine, how lucky we are that we have this program to fall back on. While I was still kind of new to the program, I'm so grateful that I had some of the lessons that you taught me in sobriety when I was first incarcerated. You know, I feel like on daily, I had to turn my life over, you know, and whenever I turned my life over, I felt free. And I lived by that one day at a time. I had my sponsor on the outside, and we were able to work through a lot of the 12 steps while I was in prison. So I wanted to just talk to you about my step 4 and 5 very quickly. Step 4 was something that I'm so grateful that I did it the way that I did it. I did it simultaneously. I wrote like an autobiography because, hey, I had nothing but time. But also I did it the way the book did it. And I remember I looked forward. We were allowed to have one AA meeting a month with outsiders coming in. But every week we had an inmate run AA meeting. And sometimes it was really difficult to get even to those. So I understand the frustrations that are involved in some institutions. And so many people hang in there in spite of that. And I'll just go off the grid for a moment. But my husband is very active in H&I, pre-COVID, that is. And he brings a meeting into the homeless shelter on Monday nights, to the jail Tuesday nights, and to the prison on Saturday nights. And almost every week, he tells me about some hurdle that he had to jump over just to get in. Or he would get in and there weren't enough guards to bring the inmates to the meeting, or, you know, something. And several times he's gone and a meeting hasn't even happened. And it's an hour drive to the prison. So there were times where, you know, even he is like, until they get it together, I am not doing it. And then the next day he's like, no, I have to do it. I'm hanging in there because, I'm committed to this. Especially being married to you, you share with me all the things how helpful that committee was in bringing the meetings to you. So he can't wait until COVID is under control so he can go back in. And by the way, my heart goes out to everyone in prison right now. Can you imagine how scary it is to be in prison during a pandemic? Oh, or to be, or being a family member, knowing that your loved one is in there. It's got to be so frightening. But anyway, I'll go back to my step 4 and 5. And we were allowed to go to Mass once a month too. So I remember I went to Mass this one month and the priest was Irish Catholic from Jersey. I couldn't believe it. And after Mass, he said, "Ladies, I want you to know that I just talked to the warden and I got permission to do fifth steps. I'm an alcoholic in recovery." And I was like, wow, this is a sign from God, you know? And actually, God bless him. His name's Father Dennis. He's still in my life. And he is actually one of the key people responsible in helping to mend my relationship with my mother. Wait till you hear this. Whenever he would go back to New Jersey, he would go visit my parents at their house and tell them how I was doing in prison, you know, because my mom wouldn't even answer the phone, you know? So anyway, I can't believe I'm getting choked up at that right now, but, you know, and he too is another one of those, I mean, that's dedicated to hospitals and institutions as a priest, and the commitment and the vocation is real. And so anyway, I did my fourth step, as I told you, super thorough. And when I did my fifth step with Father Dennis, oh, it was like I became free, you know? I became less of a freak and more of a member of society. And oh my goodness, it was amazing. And I had another freeing experience with another Catholic priest on Easter week. I went to confession and I remember he was crying after my confession. And I was like, oh, he must be really touched by my story. And then it didn't take long to find out. No, he was upset. He was like, "Jane, every month I tell you, God forgives you. Your sin is thrown out there into the sea of forgiveness, but you keep reeling it back in. If I could, I would pick you up and throw you against that wall and slap you silly. When are you going to accept God's forgiveness?" And I was like, whoa. And honestly, it was life-changing for me too, because how right he was. And he said, "Who do you think you are, above accepting God's forgiveness?" And man, did that sink in. So not only did I work on self-forgiveness, but I really worked on redemption, which I think is huge in our 12-step program, you know, especially in all the steps after step five. So anyway, slowly but surely in prison, I want to talk about some of the other things that I learned in prison very quickly. I feel like I, of course, learned to abandon my pride and seek humility. As I mentioned, I learned that every time I put my will between me and God is when things went awry, you know? But I also learned what our literature says. I learned how not to drift into remorse, worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, because that would diminish my usefulness to others. And I learned all about service in prison. How to be of service. Some of the women that I met, and all of you can attest to this, are the finest women that I've ever met in my life, you know, and most of them were in there because of their man and they got caught up in that web of whatever it was. But I'll tell you something, I had to be useful in there. And that was what really kept me going day by day. I started a literacy program My first 2 years, and then the last 3 years, I helped women who were to prepare for their high school equivalency exam. And I also just, I mean, I got involved in little, I learned how to knit, and then I became a knitting teacher for other inmates. And I'll tell you, knitting was my savior. I would knit and listen to music and pray. And if you knew me, you got a sweater or a scarf or something from me. And one of the other things that I want to talk about too, that I learned in prison is how to cut through the lies that I told myself, my own self-deceptions. You know, that was tricky for me. I also learned how to deal with two of my biggest character defects. One of them was resentments, and the other one was being judgmental. And I'll tell you something, right before the accident, I remember I, am I back? Right before the accident, I had a date with a guy who over dinner, he told me he did some time in prison. And I was like, I'm not going out with this guy again. You know, oh my God, you know, I was so judgmental. And I feel terrible about that. And resentments, oh my goodness. Well, you heard the story about my mother. Well, my my whole family, I dealt with some resentments, except for my dad. My dad came to visit me in prison twice a year. And my siblings came once a year. My siblings, that's too much. They would come, each of my siblings came once, I should put it that way. And, you know, they were busy with their families, but my family chose to do the tough love thing. I'm here to tell you that not once did I get one penny from any of my family members the whole time I was in prison. Now, if you know about prison, you know, we need money to, you know, to get canteen and to, you know, it would be nice to have even get some ramen noodles as an escape from the prison food. But, you know, I didn't get any money from my family. You know, what my husband loves when I imitate my mother, but my mother was probably saying, oh, you think we're going to send you money so you can eat potato chips and drink Coca-Cola while you're in prison? I don't think so, you know? And, you know, that's really how they rolled. And now that I'm, you know, many years later, I'm kind of grateful that they did that, you know, because there was no way I was going back to prison. And I also am grateful that they really did take a back seat. I see so many people who drag their families through the mud when they're in prison. And while I always knew that I had my family's love and encouragement and support, my mother came around probably after a year or two in prison. I wanted to do it on myself. It was my issue. It was my deal. So I didn't need people coming to visit me all the time. As a matter of fact, I liked doing my time on my own. I had my recovery family, and I wanted my family to just go on living their lives. And so anyway, I just wanted to throw that in. So you can imagine how you all became my family when I was in prison. So I wanted to share too that there were, you know, living in prison too is not easy. You know, I really learned how to be patient and tolerant and kind and loving because let's face it, many times jails and prisons are like the new mental institutions. They're the new community mental health hospitals. And it wasn't easy living in that environment. And because I was in a private prison, not only was the food terrible, but they had like a big open gymnasium with bunks in it. So the noise level at all times was unbelievable. I used to have to put my headphones on and put it on 10 to listen to classical music just to be able to read a book, you know? I also, when I did get visits from my family members, this is another reason why I didn't like doing it. We had to get strip searched, and I don't know if you can only imagine how humiliating and degrading that is. Like, still, I cry about it, but to have to, you know, bend over and spread your butt cheeks and have somebody make, you know, jokes about it and laugh. I mean, it's traumatizing. So I was like, you know what? I can do that a couple times a year, but that's it. So, you know, I mean, those things, those memories are coming up a lot for me when I'm sharing today. And believe me, I'm okay. It's just, I think I feel emotionally raw because I'm sharing some of these very private stories with a very private group, but still I'm feeling very raw and vulnerable right now. So anytime, let's get back to happier things. One of the other things that I really appreciated was the opportunity to have a sponsor and the women who brought the meetings into the prisons. And it was three women that I'm talking about in particular that I loved so much. You know, they had what I wanted. They were all cool and funny. They traveled an hour also to get there from Tallahassee. They were just lovely. And I would do some written work for them, or even they invited me to journal. And then I would give my journal readings to them. And then they would, write something back to me the next week and hand it to me, because we weren't allowed to have many one-on-one interactions. And I'll tell you something, I just loved them so much. So once again, thank you to everyone for what it is that you do. And thank you for believing in us and making us feel like we were valuable enough for you to make that hour-long trip to come see us. Okay, let's talk about when I got out of prison, because I'm seeing that, you know, we're running low on time, but I think it's really important to share somebody who really took this opportunity to turn their lives around and change things up very seriously. And I also want to re-mention that I had 10 years of probation. Even my probation officer was like, oh my God, I never heard that before, you know? And I was like, yeah, I know, 10 years. And let me share with you the terms of my probation. I had to go to an AA meeting every day for 10 years, right? Wow, I lost my license for life. So that did not make that task very easy. and I had to go to therapy once a month, which was really a challenge, because here I am trying to work a minimum wage job and have to tell my boss that I have to go to therapy, you know, that I have to go to therapy and report to probation once a month. So that's, sometimes I would sit in the probation office waiting for like 2-3 hours just to see my officer. So it led to a lot of stress and a lot of challenges. But you know what? I was not going back to prison. So everything probation told me to do, I did. So I built my life around the AA house here in Tallahassee. And let me share a little bit about the day I got out. So the day I got out of prison, I had my hefty bag of all my earthly belongings. I hopped into a cab and I could not believe the song that was playing on the radio in the cab. I just burst into tears because I thought it was a sign from God. And the cab driver was like, are you okay? Why are you crying? I said, I can't believe this song is playing. And I just got out of prison after 5 years. And so he turned it up and we sang it together. I'm as free as a bird now. I mean, come on. So anyway, and I dropped my hefty bag of stuff off at my new apartment. And I went to what is now my home group, 909 Central Group in Tallahassee. And get this, guess who was at the meeting? The three women that brought the meeting into prison. And I had no idea that was the meeting that they went to. They were like, oh my God, when did you get out? I was like, today. They were like, what? I mean, I couldn't believe it. And we hugged and we cried and oh my God, I couldn't believe that they were like my lifeline, and here they were at this meeting. Unbelievable. Let me share this other story, because within this month, my therapist that I had just met through, by the way, the priest friend I mentioned, Father O'Brien, he suggested this therapist because she was a member of our program. And she's my mentor. I love her so much. She's in her 80s and she's still so amazing. But anyway, she said, okay, Jane, I'm telling you right now, in a couple of weeks, we're going to an AA women's convention in St. Simon's Island, Georgia. And I remember thinking, oh, great. That sounds like a lot of fun, you know, because I had no idea what conventions were about or anything. All I knew was like, I still wasn't cool being around a lot of people, because prison really does mess you up like that. And but anyway, I went to this AA women's retreat, and I couldn't believe the love and the magic that I felt at that retreat or at that convention. And here's another miracle. So the first woman speaker was that I ever heard in my life was amazing. And she went on to talk about how she was an alcoholic mom and she neglected her two kids, her two sons. And, you know, I remember thinking, oh my God, this woman is like sharing this deep secrets, these things with this room full of strangers. How courageous is that? Well, guess what? That woman is the amazing Polly P. And today she is my mother-in-law. I mean, what are the chances that that would happen? And, you know, I mean, it just shows that God's hand was in my recovery from the very beginning. And, you know, I didn't marry James until 4 years ago. So that we're talking, you know, that was back in the 2001, right when I got out of prison. And so anyway, I just wanted to share that because the miracles just keep happening in my life and they're all related to my, you know, my consistency with this program. I ended up, you know, doing whatever I needed to do to get the terms of my probation done. And I'll tell you, after 10 years, that was one of the happiest days of my life when I was off of probation. But in the meantime, I did whatever I needed to do. And I want to share this amazing story too. It was the 20th anniversary of my accident. And somebody heard one of my CDs down in the Florida Keys and they invited me to share at their gratitude dinner. And I did. And my hostess who picked me up at the airport actually worked for the court system. And she was able to tell the judge that sentenced me that I was speaking at this gratitude dinner. And guess what? The judge came to the gratitude dinner and heard me share my story. And I was able to hug her and she hugged me. And oh my God, we both cried. And we were just like, she said, you don't know what this means to me because very rarely do I hear about the success stories, which is one of the reasons why I'm so happy that I get to share this with you all too, because I'm sure you can say the same thing. But I was able to tell her that she helped to save my life. And I also have shared that with those three women that bought the meetings into the prison too. They did, they helped to save my life. But my life has been amazing. I see I just have a few minutes left, so I'll share briefly what it's like now. I went back to school. A lot of people gave me second chances. And I would say that, like, where would any of us be without a second chance? Where would any of us be without forgiveness? Please, I won't let you down. And whenever I got those chances, I never let them down. I went back to college. I got my MSW. And my first job post-MSW was working in a detox. Again, how perfect is that? And after several years, I got a call from the dean at the College of Social Work asking if I would be interested in a faculty position. And today, I have been there for 15 years now. I am a teaching professor at Florida State University's College of Social Work. And I love my job so much. I am the go-to person for students on campus who are having struggles with substance use disorders. And I'll tell you something, I really miss being on campus. I'm teaching remotely right now, but once again, I am so filled with gratitude that that I have a job, you know. I am here to tell you I was able to rebuild my relationship with my family. You know, I tried making amends with them and they were like, you know what, save it, Janie. Let's wait to see you putting the pedal to the metal with regards to your honesty, your self-responsibility and all of that stuff. And after many years, they've said, she's doing it. We knew it. She's doing it, you know. So I'm so grateful for being back in my family's fold. At 2009, I went to the Florida State Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard a speaker there, his name's James L. And when I went up to thank him for sharing his story, when we were face to face, I had this look of instant recognition that this was the man I was going to be with for the rest of my life. It was so weird. I never had that before. As a matter of fact, I've never been married. I've never cohabitated with anyone before. And then I looked down and I saw a wedding ring on his finger. And I was like, oh, I was wrong there. But thanks to Facebook, we became Facebook friends. I think it was about 5 years later, I heard through the AA grapevine that sadly he was going through a very difficult divorce. And while my heart was breaking for him, because at my age, I have had so many friends who have been through difficult divorces, a small part of me was like, I knew it. And it worked out because his mom lives in Jacksonville. So he went to visit his mom, asked if he could come and take me out to lunch. Lunch turned out to dinner, and dinner turned out to be happily ever after. And we got married 4 years ago. And I'm here to tell you, my husband is the finest man I've ever met in my life. He got sober at 21. He's 58 now, still knee deep in this program, as I mentioned to you earlier. You know, and he has a program. I aspire to be a member of AA like James is. He never gets his feathers ruffled. And he's just an amazing man, an amazing person. And I am so lucky he's my husband. Oh, and he's hot. And he has been the perfect quarantine partner. And we've been doing it the way we're supposed to be doing it. So this has been an amazing test of our compatibility, and we're passing with flying colors. And I just want to say, I think I've covered everything. Oh no, just very quickly, a couple miracles. My mother, who is now my biggest advocate, started writing to Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey, like, why can she still not drive? Why can you get rid of that first DUI she got? You know, this is crazy. She's 58 years old, still riding her bike around. She got hit by a car once. She got hit by another biker. And you know, somehow the letter ended up in his hands. And on his last night as governor in the state of New Jersey, he called me himself. And he's like, hello, Jane, this is Governor Chris Christie. I was like, what? And immediately I started, you know, hooping and hollering. And he was laughing. And he just said, let me tell you, I've read everything that your mother has shared with me. I happen to love your 12-step program. I have had friends who it saved their lives and family members saved their lives. I'm giving you a pardon. And it opened the door for me to get my hardship license. So I just started driving again after 23 years. And another miracle is this past election, I was finally able to get my voting rights restored. And I was able to vote for in this presidential election. Thank goodness, what an election it was for me to be able to vote in. And I also have been, just as a side note, I've been very involved in the restoration of voting rights, especially for inmates. There's no reason why for 24 years I was not allowed to vote. It just infuriates me. So those are just some side things that I wanted to share before I closed. The miracles just keep happening. And once again, I want to thank all of you for what you do. And I wish you and all of your loved ones health, safety, and peace. Thank you so much.